You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bob. How's it going?
Can't complain, Tim. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Timothy B. Lee, publisher of the influential AI newsletter, Understanding AI. And we are going to settle a question once and for all. Sam Altman, good or evil? We've both read very informative books about him. I actually listened to them, but
Sam,
one of them has hit the bestsellers list, Empire of AI by Karen Howe. Congratulations to her. And then the other is called The Optimist. And I actually am not looking at the author's name right now.
It's Hagee is her name.
You know her?
I don't know. I think she's at the Journal.
Yeah, she is. Anyway, so this is kind of a comparative book review, but also I'm going to be pressing you for the on the good or evil question. I know I have my views, but for starters, what would you? I found them both engrossing. I mean, I'm very interested in the subject, but if you want to know about AI and or Sam Altman, I'd recommend both of them. What would you say by way of comparison or anything else?
I mean, they're pretty different books. I would say that the big difference I would say is that The Optimist is a traditional biography of Sam Altman. Mm-hmm. It goes back to his childhood, goes into some detail about his time at Y Combinator, which was the kind of job he had before he started OpenAI. And just reads like a traditional biography. Whereas Empire of AI is like an ideological book. It really has a left-wing worldview about here's how we should understand AI. And it mostly focuses on OpenAI and on Sam Altman, but it has a much more clear thesis of like, you know, it has this running comparison to imperialism,
right.
Which I think was a little bit overdone. But the idea is like this whole enterprise is bad and in a kind of left-wing way. And so
now,
depending on kind of what you're looking for, I think they're
I would say
books.
The two parts of that book are separable, both in the sense that I personally thought her depiction of Altman was not all that colored, but you tell me if you disagree, by her negative view of the industry and the enterprise. It's also separable in the sense that, for the most part, the chapters, you'll see which chapters are going to go off on what, if you're not on the left or her part of the left, you may consider ideological tangents. It's easy to identify them and skip them for the most part. And if you take them out, there's pretty much just a short story of OpenAI and Sam Altman. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it's a more negative depiction of him than the other one, maybe. I mean, it is, but it didn't strike me as being kind of corrupted by the ideological worldview. I thought it was really a good piece of reporting. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. Both of them, I think, were well reported. And yeah, I think Karen Howe clearly did a ton of work on this. And mm-hmm. I was particularly struck. You know, we've talked in previous episodes about the, I guess what's now called the blip, the time when the board tried to fire Sam Altman. And mm-hmm. the stories are pretty similar. I mean, they have the same mm-hmm. characters doing basically the same things that are playing out the same way. So, I think, I think they both paint a very similar portrait of Sam Altman, which is he's this very ambitious guy who is basically willing to say whatever he has to say to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. And is that kind of not clear what he wants in the larger picture? I mean, he wants to be a powerful, influential person. It seems like he mostly maybe means well with all that power, aside from kind of willing to be very opportunistic in order to get it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one or both of them quote Paul Graham. I had heard this quote before. Paul Graham, founder of Y Combinator, this kind of incubator, Sam Altman became the, I guess, president of or something when Graham kind of moved over to a less direct kind of control when he moved to chairman. And this was a huge break for Sam Altman, by the way, I think. It really put him in position to use all his skills to network. And it's from there that he leapt into the AI business. We can talk about that. Anyway, there's this famous Paul Graham quote that, you know, Sam is good at becoming powerful. And my sense is, although he clearly does not have an aversion to wealth, he is probably more of those two things, money and power. I think he's more interested in the power. I am not persuaded that he is wedding that with any kind of authentic ideological or you know, aspiration. I don't, maybe I'm too cynical, but it seems to me he likes power, like so many of us. Most of us just don't get it, but
no, I think he's trying harder to get it than most people. I mean, the famous Paul Graham quote is you could parachute him into an island of cannibals and
right,
come back
too.
5 years later and he would be king. And yeah, you really see that. I mean, I was really struck. So he drops out of Stanford to do a Y Combinator startup. And the Y Combinator startup was called Looped. And the thing that was really remarkable about that is they had it was this like location-based social network similar to Foursquare. But the business, they did this before the iPhone came along. And so to actually make this work, they had to get deals with all these big wireless companies. And so you had this like 21, 22-year-old guy that was going around to all these wireless companies and somehow talking them into doing like multi-million dollar commercial relationships. And I thought that was just really, that gave me like an insight into his character, because he's the kind of person where, you know, you put him in a room with somebody who's much older and much more experienced, and they come around really charmed. They think he's brilliant. Apparently he has excellent recall of facts. He's very curious about different things. And so, yeah, he'll come in, he's very well prepared, and he'll just kind of make you think he's one of the smartest people you've ever met. I've never met the guy, so I can't, you know, say personally whether this is true or not. But it sounds like over and over again this happened. He would, if he can get, he was an excellent fundraiser, if he could get in a room with somebody, he could charm them and convince them that,
yeah,
that he's somebody that you want to support.
Well, he clearly is very smart. He also seems to me good at, just based on, you know, seeing his public appearances and podcast appearances and so on, of like, on the one hand, giving you the marketing pitch that it's in his interest to give you, but mixing that with enough kind of candor of a kind or something that's unusual in Silicon Valley marketing pitches that imparts a little more credibility to the pitch. It's not just your, you know, there's a type of like founder pitch, and it's just like you hear the first 2 minutes of the podcast and you turn it off because it's just like it's too purely a marketing pitch. He's an interesting guy. He says some things that it seems like maybe it's not in his interest to say, and that adds to his credibility. But he's clearly a master of several tools you need to get where he's gotten.
Well, I think this is related to the character issue that both of these books highlighted, which is that he's willing to say whatever it takes to get what he wants. And it's actually, I mean, I think it's easier to be charming when you could like figure out what the person you're talking to wants to hear and tell them that whether or not it's true or not. Like that makes it easier for you to like to charm like kind of anybody you meet. And I think that one of the patterns we saw is that people are initially charmed by him and then kind of turned off over time. I mean, so he was elevated to the president of Y Combinator, I think, at age 29, and then almost immediately proceeds to spit off all these side projects and kind of not pay that much attention to Y Combinator. And Paul Graham and his wife ended up kind of, I think, a little bit estranged from him because they were annoyed that they'd given him this big break, and he'd kind of taken it for granted and got out to start OpenAI and invested all these outside projects and stuff. And you also saw this, you know, in 2023, he testified at the Senate, and this was very widely praised. But one of the things he said was he wasn't making any money from his relationship to OpenAI, which is like true in a technical sense. But apparently he like personally owed the OpenAI AI like venture capital arm in a way that the board didn't know about, and was like making money for that, and had all these, you know, OpenAI had all these commercial relationships with companies that Sam was an investor in. And so, yeah, he's very good at figuring out what's the thing to say that'll make me sound sincere and sympathetic. But then I think when people spend time with him and start to notice, oh, actually, some of the things you told me weren't true, and you're telling different people different things that, you know, contradict each other, then some of that charm kind of wears off in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, he has his enduring supporters, and a lot of them are important people, like, what's his name? Is it Brian Chesky, who founded Airbnb and really helped him recover from that attempted coup and regain power? I guess Greg Brockman is... been a pretty consistent supporter. He's one of the co-founders of OpenAI. He stood by him. And, you know, one thing I wonder, I mean, the question arises, well, first of all, let me ask you, is this consistent with the scuttlebutt you've heard? Because I had long heard, I mean, I haven't done extensive research, but more than one person from Silicon Valley had said to me, you know, you just can't trust him as far as you can throw him. One person used the term pathological liar. Had you, are these two presentations of him? And again, the Karen Howe book is probably the more negative of the two, but they both convey that he is not always to be trusted. Is that consistent with the view of him you had going in?
Yeah, I would not say I have a lot of private sourcing on this. And so my view is mostly shaped by these two books and what kind of other people have said publicly. But it seems like there's been basically no pushback on this. I mean, I don't think there's anybody who's saying, you know, no, like Sam Altman's a total straight arrow and none of this stuff happened. Like it seems like, and you see the stream of departures from OpenAI the last couple of years. You know, it's always hard to get people to be super honest about why they're departing, but many of them seem pretty pissed off. So I find it totally credible that the description of these books is accurate. And a few times I've had an opportunity to talk to OpenAI insiders, certainly many of them have the same impression.
Yeah. So I think you're right. He tells people what they want to hear. He's good at reading the room and knowing. I mean, it's so funny that he and Elon Musk are locked in some kind of death struggle because they are on two ends of this reading the room spectrum, right? Mm. Elon couldn't read a room to save his life. And Altman is a master of it. One thing, it seems like a certain amount of deception is not like saying something that is yet untrue. It's just saying things to different people that couldn't both be true. But then there are, you know, like, yeah, oh, yeah, you're right. We'll go with your plan. And oh yeah, we'll go with your plan. And you can't do both. Or you'll be the one in charge of this. You'll be the one in charge of this. But a certain amount of it is just flagrant deception, like when he tells one member of the board, and this actually contributed to the attempted dethroning of him by the board, when he tells one member of the board that another member of the board, I think it was a member of the board he told. Anyway, he's claiming that one member of the board has said another member of the board should be kicked off the board or should leave the board or something. And when I first heard that he had said this and it was false, I kind of reserved judgment. But having read both books, I think that's exactly right. It was definitely not true. He definitely said it. He just seems to have made it up out of whole cloth. It's a very consequential lie. It's the kind of thing you could get fired for. Yeah. So it's kind of amazing that, well, I at first I was thinking, It's amazing that it didn't catch up with him sooner and in a bigger way. But then I thought, well, maybe he is generally pretty careful about who he misleads, who he gives reason to have a big grudge against him. You know, I think he once called Trump an NPC, you know, a non-playable character, meaning somebody with not much agency, not that smart, of course, and it's gamer terminology. And I wonder if he doesn't like kind of, he later apologized for that, of course, and said he'd been wrong. I wonder if he doesn't go through life kind of making that, well, this is an NPC. I'll tell him what they, you know, I'll just tell whatever it takes to shut him up. And then I'm wondering if there aren't a few people up there, you know, in the pantheon that he treats very differently. That's one explanation.
Yeah, well, I think when you're running a big organization, like most interactions you have with people lower on the hierarchy are getting pretty brief. And you could just like be nice to them, be a little vague, like not say anything very specific. And there's only going to be a handful of 5 or 10 people where you actually have to have specific conversations and make specific, you know, comments or commitments about various things. And so one of the other things both books makes clear, I think, is that he's very good at like favor trading. Like one of the things he'll say to almost anybody he meets is like, how can I help you out? And he loves to help you raise money for your startup or make an introduction to somebody you want to talk to. And so he has this like vast network of people who feel that they have some relationship with him, feel grateful towards him. And he can then mobilize that network to accomplish whatever kind of goals. And so that kind of positive sum networking where he's just doing lots of favors with people, that I think is allows him to wield a lot of influence without having to lie to anybody. And so, yeah, I mean, I think for the most part, he's probably a pleasant guy to work with. And most people just never see this side of him in a clear enough way that they could say, oh, that was like clearly a lie, as opposed to,
you know,
you know, just shading the truth.
In that world, at the higher levels of kind of, you know, capitalist power and aspiration, most of the people you're dealing with are used to dealing with cutthroat, you know, Machiavellian people.
Yeah.
And they may just think, well, I know how to make sure I don't fall prey to it. And that's the deal. But you're right. The how can I help question is funny. After they called, after they notified, the board notified him that he had been fired at the end of the call, he said, well, how can I help? And they should have said, by not immediately embarking on a conspiracy to reverse our ruling, but they didn't. And that's what he did, which was masterful. You know, for people who don't know, I mean, maybe we should, let's start at the beginning and get back to that. So I have a question for you about what you think was going on in his head at the founding of OpenAI. So he, I think, approaches Elon Musk. I mean, they knew each other probably, but I think he's the first one on record to suggest that they start a, and he may have suggested a nonprofit from the beginning, but an AI outfit that would have the virtue of making sure that Google didn't get a, you know, have a monopoly on AI. I think it's in the initial message, Elon, he says something like, look, it looks like, you know, like I share, you know, he's conveyed that he shares Elon's concern about the risk and existential risk, but it looks like you're not going to be able to stop this stuff. So the least they can do is make sure Google doesn't monopolize it, right? And he approaches Elon with that pitch, right?
Well, I think this has been Elon's position for a little while prior to this. I forget the exact chronology, but I believe he had a big argument with Larry Page, where, you know, Elon was like, hey, these AI systems might be dangerous, and Larry Page was dismissive about it, and Elon came away from that conversation very concerned that, like, this stuff's going to be dangerous and I don't want Google to control it. And so I think this was something he'd been talking about. And I think maybe this goes back to Sam Altman's talent for telling people what they want to hear. Like, at this point, Elon was a much more prominent person than Sam Altman or anybody else involved in OpenAI. I was looking back at the early coverage of OpenAI's founding, and a number of the headlines describe it as Elon Musk's OpenAI. Like, it was like his credibility and money is what made OpenAI possible. And I think of it as like Sam Altman kind of charming Elon into making him a co-founder of something where really it was like Elon's money and social capital that made it possible.
Yeah, in fact, if the earliest, you know, Altman has these kind of Doomer-esque quotes that people drag up now to say, oh, now he seems to want to move as fast as possible on AI, but there was a time when he was terrified that it would destroy humanity. And the earliest of those quotes I've seen was on his, that about what superintelligence could do to us, was put on his blog right around the birth of OpenAI. So that is not inconsistent with the hypothesis that the whole Doomer thing is a pose that he knew would work with Elon. We don't know. I don't have overwhelming evidence of that, but I have not seen anything that would refute it.
I mean, you never know. Like, I don't have any reason to think he was insincere about that. Like, Nick Bostrom's book had just come out a year earlier, and I think both Sam Altman and Elon Musk had read it, and I think there'd been like a big conference to try to get some of the tech leaders together with some of the Doomer types. So I think this was like in the air. It was a kind of fashionable thing.
Oh, yeah, he didn't invent it.
Yeah.
But I mean, so
I just don't think you could know, like, did he like secretly not really believe this? My guess is he was sincere. Like, you know, there's lots of things he could have done, but certainly foregrounding that would be a way to, and specifically focusing on the kind of threat for Google would be a way of appealing to what Elon Musk was interested in.
Yeah, I mean, but you have to, I guess I would say, compare him to Dario Amodei, head of Anthropic, who's among the people who had a falling out with Altman and Dario, having kind of led the team that created the first pretty powerful GPT, I guess. You know, went and founded Anthropic, which was going to be more safety oriented. And I think there's a lot to complain about with him and his commitment to safety, but you still see, it still seems sincere. Anthropic still does a number of things that OpenAI is not doing that to me signify an actual concern with the future of AI. Does that seem crazy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that my understanding is the corporate culture of Anthropic, they think of themselves as a policy shop, a AI doom shop, and then they have to do this technology development to stay on the frontier, so they're influential. But the culture is still very much focused on AI safety to a greater degree than the other companies.
Yeah. Now, they are moving pretty briskly ahead, but they don't seem as bent on headlong kind of racing as Altman does. Did you, by the way, okay, so he, you know, by the time the board thing happened, so for people who weren't paying super close attention, I think it's the end of 2022 when Chat GPT 3.5 gets everybody's attention. Only a few months later, early 2024, GPT-4 comes out and is really impressive. And so at that point, it's all, by then, you know, he's talk of the town. And then only half a year later, right, is the board coup, when the board tells him he's fired, and he is fired, stages a miraculous counter-revolution. We can talk a little about that. But I'm wondering, did you ask yourself, how could the board have prevailed? What would you do different with the benefit of either Monday morning quarterbacking hindsight or just maybe having a little more political savvy, which I don't think that board was overloaded with in the first place? What would you have done differently that might have made the firing stick?
I mean, I think they were just, like you said, they lacked political savvy. And I think they were the kind of people who were way too formalistic in thinking about how the company was operated. So that the theory is the board's in charge and it can fire the CEO if it wants it. So that's what they did. And what they needed is they needed to build a coalition of people. I actually think certainly the Kitagi book, I think that also the Carrot How book, but particularly the Kitagi book, I think is actually kind of scathing about Meera Murati, the way they portray her, in that she, and it's a little bit hard from these secondhand reports exactly what the dynamic was, but she was clearly pretty frustrated. Ilya was also pretty frustrated. But I think the board's expectation was, okay, we're going to fire Sam Altman. We're going to make Meera Murati, who is the CTO, one of the top, executives. And I think somebody who was kind of the operations chief for Sam Altman, like she was the one that actually made things work and kind of smoothed over ruffled feathers. So she was like a very influential person. The board's expectation was, okay, we're going to fire Sam. We're going to put Meera in charge. And then Meera would embrace that and say, okay, like I'm in charge now, not necessarily permanently, but like she would defend with the board's decision and use her kind of fixer abilities to, you know, bring other people on board. And instead, she like just kept her mouth shut and was like, the board made the decision, like portrayed herself as like, you know, a non-participant. And that put the board in a really difficult position because, you know, it meant that the management of OpenAI was arrayed against her, against the board. The other big mistake they made is they didn't talk to Microsoft at all. So I think what they needed to do was get Meera Murati on board to like publicly support the decision, get Ilya on board. I mean, I guess he supported it, but get him kind of more firmed up, make sure he was on board, and then get Microsoft, get Satya Nadella to be okay with this. And that would have made a big difference because most of Sam's leverage came from the fact that Microsoft was pissed off about this. They put up a lot of money into this company, didn't want to see it in turmoil. And they saw a big opportunity of, okay, well, we're going to come and we're going to just hire Sam Altman and basically transfer all of OpenAI's personnel to Microsoft. That would have been a huge coup for them. And if Microsoft had not been willing to pass it, if the board had gone to Satya and said, hey, you know, we're not happy with Sam, would you be okay with us firing him? And he committed to it. I think Sam would have had a lot less leverage because he wouldn't have had the ability to offer hundreds of people jobs. And they didn't, apparently they notified Microsoft like 30 minutes before it became public. And so understandably, he was upset. I think what was happening is because Sam is such a savvy operator, they were very, very worried that if he got wind of what was happening, he would use his political skills to undermine the board and prevent this from happening. But, you know, like that's how politics works. Like you can't, you know, as the saying goes, if you come with the king, you have to kill him. Like you have to have your ducks in a row before you do it. And if you don't feel like you have the kind of political base to withstand like a counterattack from Sam Altman, then you need to like hold your fire. They just kind of went in half-cocked and didn't have the, you know, the support lineup that they needed to.
Yeah. I actually do think there's one more thing they could have done that would have pretty much ensured their success, the board, their success in firing Altman. Let me provide a little more context, especially for people who don't follow this stuff super closely. So first of all, Ilya you mentioned is Ilya Sutskever, one of the most important figures in the deep learning revolution, which is the phase of AI development we're in now. Yeah. Really, really important figure, revered pretty much within AI for his kind of intellectual heft. He was both, it was an odd situation. He was on the board, Altman was on the board, Greg Brockman was on the board, and all three of them worked at OpenAI. And then there were these board members who, for the most part, were more like the kind of people you'd expect to see on a nonprofit board, Helen Toner and two or three others. From at least two of them were from more of like an academic. They were more the kinds of people you'd expect to be concerned about honoring the actual charter, the mission of the nonprofit, and so on. Ilya Sutskever seems to me like the closest thing there is to a prime mover behind the attempted coup.
Yeah.
I think Marathi may have been a little more in on it a little earlier than is evident from the public record. I'm not sure. One of the accounts of the coup in one of the books begins with her having coffee with Helen Toner or something, and apparently not doing a lot of complaining about Sam at that point. But anyway, there was a sentence or two suggestive that there's trouble in Denmark. Then Ilya, really kind of works to make the board aware of Altman's problems. He's telling people different things. He and so on. And at that point, Marathi seems to be kind of playing ball. I mean, first of all, she gives Ilya a long record of like exchanges she had with him. This is textual evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That Altman was saying things that were misleading and so on.
I think this is related to what I was saying, in that like part of their weakness is the employees were like, okay, you said Sam wasn't candid. Give us some examples. And the examples all came from Ilya and Mary Marathi, who were not willing to kind of be the face of the effort. And so they couldn't say, okay, here's the big document that Mary gave us, because, you know, a lot of that information was confidential. But they didn't do the work to say, okay, here's what the announcement is going to look like. Here's the three examples we're going to use that Ilya and Mira and the board are all comfortable using. And so they just had this kind of vague statement that then made it look like it was a totally arbitrary decision.
Right. Now this is what I think they could have done differently. I mean, you're right. They should have touched base with Microsoft earlier. I mean, remember what had happened was Altman and Musk, everybody had realized, OpenAI wasn't founded thinking that they would do these large language models. They were trying other approaches. At some point, it became evidence that LLMs are going to be super important. You were going to need a lot of scale. And so they were going to need a partner like Microsoft, or a partner that could bring a lot of capital and or compute resources to the project. So they have this weird deal where there's a subsidiary that's for profit, but with capped returns for investment. It's very strange. But Microsoft is a key player. And in fact, what wound up happening is after the board fires Altman, Microsoft eventually says, well, we will hire Sam Altman and everyone who wants to leave OpenAI for Microsoft. And basically, like, we'll recreate OpenAI. And at that point, the board was kind of toast. But what I think they could have done, in addition to the get a little more explicit of a commitment around Mira Marathi, for example, and so on. Because both she and Ilya pretty quickly caved and turned and joined the counter revolution. They had started the revolution, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, what I think the board could have done is, now I don't think they could issue an official public statement listing the things Altman had done. Remember, what they said was, he has not been consistently candid with the board. And everybody's going like, what the hell does that mean? And they never elaborated. And in fact, when Ilya had an all-hands meeting to explain to people at the company what had happened, They said, well, will we ever find out what he did wrong? And Elias said, no. I think he had done enough things wrong. I mean, lying about to one board member about the other, as I had said, concealing the fact that what was called the investment arm of OpenAI, he had in fact made himself the owner of without disclosing that.
Yeah.
And various other things, like, for example, not telling the board that actually this safety thing they definitely were supposed to go through is, like, on paper, when certain things happen, you got to run things by the safety board. That he hadn't done it. Moreover, he lied to somebody at OpenAI and said, well, our lawyer, the OpenAI's lawyer, in one of these cases, said that we don't have to run this one by the safety board or something. It was just a lie. The lawyer later said he never said that. Anyway, there was enough stuff that if they had found a way to make that public without seeming to make it public, for example, they could have sent an email to just the top echelon of OpenAI employees. We know you're wondering. Send it to 10, 15, whatever. And then if none of them leak it, well, then you leak it. But I think if that had been on the record, I don't think Microsoft could have said, hey, he's our guy. I really don't.
Yeah totally.
And I also think the employees wouldn't have joined him in staging the revolt. Now, there was this financial incentive for them to worry about his departure, which is that they were employees. If investors lost interest, if there weren't in OpenAI and there weren't subsequent rounds of robust investment, the employers would have lost money. And it seemed like Altman was good at keeping the investment money coming in. And there may have been some imminent deadline regarding that, but there was that consideration. But I think the other thing is, I might have had on the all hands meeting, I think I would have had Helen Toner do it. Not because the other narrative that hurt the board is this is all a coup by Elia. So they have Elia show up and tell the employees this is happening. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And that just feeds the Elia conspiracy narrative. I think, you know, hindsight is easy, but I think it was doable.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that going both ways, because Elia does have a lot of credibility. And there was this alternative narrative floating around that this was like an EA coup, that they had all these safety people who were, you know, terrified. There was this reporting that there was early versions of the model that became O1, the reasoning model, that they're very worried this was going to become AGI and, like, take over the world. And it seems like both books agree that was really not the issue. I mean, you know, some of the people in that camp were involved in this action, but there was nobody did it because they expected that to be imminent. But if you make Helen Toner the face of the firing in a more direct way, I think that would feed that kind of story more. So no, I agree with you. Having people bought in and having specific examples of misconduct were the two things they needed to do. And I think they were just kind of over their skis. Like, one of the issues they had is that the part of the reason it happened when it happened is that they'd had some attrition from the board. And previously, it had been like Sam Loyalist had a majority on the board. Several of them had left, and so you had a six-person board, of which you had Ilya and the four independent board members were the kind of majority that ended up firing Sam. They were worried that would not last, that they'd add new people, and whoever Sam suggested would be like a Sam Loyalist, and they might lose their majority. So I think they felt this kind of urgency to act quickly, and so I think they did it in a kind of haphazard way, where they really hadn't like thought through all the possible consequences and you know, made all the right preparations.
Yeah. I mean, he is a super impressive guy. I mean, the other thing is he seems to think just very fast. Mm-hmm. So he's just kind of like, you know, if you're playing conversational chess with him, I think you kind of lose.
Yes, and that's why I think they rolled it out this way, is they were terrified that once, if he got wind of it, he would start doing whatever kind of social magic he did to win these kind of battles. And so they felt the only way they could win is if they like caught him off by surprise. And they didn't think about the like second and third days of the conflict, like if, you know, whether he'd be able to kind of regain control, which is what he ended up hopefully doing.
Yeah. And in fact, the board members who wanted to fire him just met by themselves. They constituted a majority of the board. And they didn't invite, you know, Sam and Brockman. And that's when they did the firing. They did want to move fast. And only one of them was somebody you would expect to have some degree of experience at the higher levels of corporate, jockeying and strategy. Is it D'Angelo? Is his name Is he the Quora guy or what? What did he start?
Yeah, I think Quora. He's the founder of Quora. Yep.
Okay. So what else would you say about the? We can say a little about what Karen Howe's critique is.
What did you think about her kind of overall thesis about AI's empire and the kind of problems with OpenAI's approach?
Well, it's a critique. I personally think I have a big critique, and I think you'd call mine maybe left of center. I don't know, but it's not exactly this critique. Now, some of it, okay. So, for example, climate change. I agree. It is crazy that we're letting Sam Altman say, oh, yeah, I know that a few years ago I was worried about climate change like everybody else, but we're going to radically increase the amount of power consumed. And moreover, the government really should subsidize it, you know. And I know that these companies, when they do these data centers, they do something about buying green credits or something. But the fact is, you can't just suddenly sharply increase the Earth's total energy consumption without increasing the amount that's coming via carbon emissions. So I agree with that. I personally think there should be a special tax on data centers because I think AI needs to go to move more slowly. I think it's just moving at a destabilizing pace. So I think that would be a twofer if you discourage the energy consumption and slowed it down a little. Now, it'd be very hard to do that at the national level alone. I won't bore you with my international governance sermons, but I agree with her concern about climate change. And she's also concerned with workers being exploited, especially in low-income countries. You know, that's where a certain amount of the reinforcement learning through human feedback is done, I guess. And especially apparently some of the less pleasant parts, like when your workday involves reading a bunch of stories about violence and incest and shit that you don't want the model to say. And like, these are the people who identify it. So it's kind of like the people who for social media had to look at a bunch of pictures of disgusting stuff every day to train the social media network not to spread it. So there's that. The other big concern, I guess, is with the way AI can be used to discriminate against ethnic groups and stuff like that. It's one of the early concerns. So she's not, it's not a doomer critique. It's more of a, I think AI ethics is a term you sometimes hear for this part of the AI critique. I think it's all worth worrying. It's all worthy of criticism. You know, it's all worthy of concern. I just don't think it's the most massively negative aspect of AI. It's not what I'm especially focusing on. I don't know. Do you think I've characterized it fairly?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely she's not in the doomer camp. I mean, she's in the, like you said, the AI ethics camp, which their view is that this is all theoretical. And because there's so many like more pressing problems with AI that like the doom stuff is kind of a smokescreen. And so that's her view. And I guess I'm not necessarily in either camp, so I don't have like a strong view of that. I thought that the thing that was, the thing that I didn't find like super persuasive is that she felt the need to kind of wrap all these critiques up into this kind of a larger narrative that like the whole enterprise is rotten. And, I think like facts and a sense of proportion is important. So like, you were mentioning that it's problematic that these data centers are generating more are using more power and generating more carbon, and definitely that's a legitimate concern. But it's also the case that some of these AI tools have been used to reduce carbon emissions. There was she talks in some detail about a controversy over Google's data centers, where somebody did kind of a back of the envelope calculation of you know, how much do we think that how much power is consumed by a typical use of a large language model at Google. And Google's Jeff Dean did his own study where he came up with a much lower number because Google's like really good at infrastructure. They've taken made a lot of efforts to make these things more efficient. And the back of the envelope calculation had kind of used like consumer grade hardware. And I thought the book's like takeaway from that was a little odd because she basically said so Google said it's like 10 or 100 times less power consumption than this report had said. And she said, well, it's like not really fair to like criticize the researcher for this, because like Google hadn't been transparent and so they couldn't have known, which is like fine, but it's like it actually matters, like, you know, how much energy is this using. And it seems totally plausible to me that as a result of this like AI spending, we'll actually find ways to reduce emissions in ways that will exceed the amount of power that's being generated. So that just seems like kind of a complicated issue. And I felt the same way about so there's a bunch of discussion about water, which is something I feel this is something that I learned. One of the things I learned the most about, because I've seen kind of vague references to water, and now I have a much clearer idea, because she does some good reporting. She goes to different countries. And the issue there is that when you do a data center, you need to cool the chips, and you can do that either with air or with water. And, you know, water can hold a lot more heat. And so if you use water, you can cool much more efficiently, which you could pack a lot more chips into a fixed space. And I think the basic issue is that like a lot of countries, including the US, like does misprices water. Often it's underpriced. And so when you go in, there's like a limited amount of water. They like use too much of it or not pay the full cost. And this has a detrimental impact on kind of local water use. But like that seems to be kind of like a technical problem. Like individual countries should change the way their water markets work so that companies are paying full freight. And you know, if necessary, like there's nothing inherent about this technology that requires water. You could have an air-cooled data center that would be, it'd be a little more expensive because you couldn't pack the chips in so tightly, but you could do that. But like, yeah, I guess that's another place where I kind of, I thought the specific criticism was worthwhile and I'm glad she did it. But I guess I came up with less of like kind of a galaxy braid like conclusion that therefore like this whole like, you know, large language model thing is a bad idea. And it's more like, yeah, like we need a better regulatory mechanisms for industrial uses of water. Because this is not unique to data centers. I mean, in California, there's all sorts of, you know, there's regular water shortages. And a big issue is like farmers don't pay the market rate for water in California. And, you know, they're powerful. And so they, you know, it's hard to get them to pay the market rate. But it's like, yeah, I think it's ultimately what is you want, you know, market pricing for water as opposed to subsidizing certain uses at the expense of others.
Yeah. You know, as I said, it's an ideological critique. You can skip the kind of clearly ideological chapters if you want. You might ask, well, why not just read the book that's not ideological? And I would say one thing is that in certain areas, Karen Howell's reporting seems very deep to me. Yes, in a way that the other book isn't. And, you know, she spent a lot of time covering this stuff. And give her credit, like, she basically broke the story when she was writing at Technology Review that OpenAI had strayed from its mission. It really was just no longer focused on the original nonprofit mission. It was being much less transparent about research it was doing, which was supposed to be the idea. It wasn't, you know, there's a misconception. I don't think being open source per se was a prominent part of the mission, or maybe ever officially part, although Altman and Musk maybe alluded to it early on. But they did originally say, we're going to share our research. And she spent some time at OpenAI. They gave her access. This is like, I don't know, 2017 or 2018 or something. And I don't know, maybe a little later, but early, before it was a big name, before OpenAI was a big name. And she did this piece for Technology Review saying, you know, they've abandoned the mission. And that was, I think she was right. And that was very good reporting. She's done a lot of good reporting since then, some of it for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that it's a well-reported book. I learned a lot. And she, you know, she does a pretty good job of separating, like, here's the facts I've uncovered. And then, you know, here's my conclusions. I mean, the other big category, I think you mentioned briefly, is like the labor rights question. And she does a good job. She goes to, I think, Kenya. I think she talks about Venezuela. So OpenAI, in order to do the training, they need human beings to provide training data. And like you said, it can be kind of unpleasant because part of what you're doing is you're trying to prevent it from producing, you know, graphic or violent or, you know, sexual, other kinds of content that people don't want in a consumer product. And so they have to hire all these people to look at those problematic content and rate it, and it could be bad for people's mental health. And so I think she does a great job. She goes to different countries and talks to some of the people who are involved and talks about how, you know, it's this kind of piecework model where they're paid by the individual job, and the rate's not very high, but it's also very sporadic, where they'll have a bunch of work for a month or two, and then they won't hear anything for a couple months. So I found that interesting. I learned a lot. There's a company called Scale at AI that's like a big player in this. But like, I guess the thing that I came back to is a couple of the stories, like the end of the story is that there was too much. Like, one of the problems they had is once ChatGPT became available, they had people who would take the work they were supposed to do, they would use ChatGPT to come up with an answer, then they just cut and paste that into the response, which is not useful. And so certain countries, they decided this was too rampant. I think Kenya and Venezuela were two of them. And so they pulled out, and the workers were devastated because they're like, this is our livelihood. Like, we actually like this. And so I think it's totally reasonable to criticize, like, you can have more regular hours, you should pay more, et cetera. But ultimately, like, they're providing work for people in desperately poor countries. But I didn't make them desperately poor. Mm-hmm. And so the comparison to imperialism, that this is like, you know, invading some country and, you know, taking over its political system, just those seem like many orders of magnitude, like, different level of misconduct. And it just seemed a little bit overwrought. But I agree that the individual reporting is very interesting. I definitely encourage people who don't share her politics to read the book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as people know, with these podcasts, we generally do about as much as we've done in public, and then we go into overtime, and that's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I encourage everyone to be. Now you're not posting podcasts on understanding AI, are you, or are you?
Not consistently. So for a while, I had a podcast called AI Summer that I did with Dean Ball, who's right of center, I think, scholar at the Mercatus Center. I mean, then he got a job at the White House writing their AI policy, and so he's no longer available to podcast with me. So I think I probably will resurrect it at some point, but it's been a couple of months since.
I guess in principle, if you wanted to, we could make a paid subscription to your newsletter an avenue to this as well. But
I might do that. Yeah.
We might do that. So check, if you're a paid subscriber to Understanding AI, check there first before you give me your hard-earned money. But if you don't see it, then give me your hard-earned money. So anyway, thanks everybody who's stuck with us this far. We're going to keep talking. I'm gonna say something good and bad about Sam Altman. You mentioned Scale AI. I want to ask you about this Meta's acquisition of Scale AI. Seems a little weird to me, but maybe you'll explain to me. With that, let's go into overtime.